Welcome to the Focus Today podcast with Perry Atkinson.
Well, welcome back, and we are delighted to have back and honored to have back with us today Dr. Andrew Bostrom. He is an MD. He's an academic clinical trialist and epidemiologist who is currently a research physician at the Brown University Center for Primary Care and Prevention of the Kent Memorial Hospital there in Rhode Island. Dr. Brown's the author of several books, including The Legacy of Jihad and The Legacy of Islamic Anti-Semitism. And so he's just one busy guy. We're honored to have him with us today. You can go to Andrew Bostom, that's BOSTOM.org is his website. And that's AndrewBostom.org. Dr. Bostom, good to see you again, friend. How are you?
Good to see you again, Perry.
Thanks for your time. Sure. You recently were an expert witness at the Tennessee case concerning COVID vaccines in children. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to say it was the polar opposite of a very bitter experience I had, which came to a conclusion around this time last year. So both of these cases, Perry, were involved divorced parents. And as I'm sure you're familiar with, in divorce cases, children are sadly often used as pawns to settle unresolved issues between the parents. And vaccination, COVID vaccination, has fallen into that sad domain. In the case in Rhode Island, I would say it had a tragic conclusion because two young healthy girls, 5 to 7 years of age, who'd had COVID twice, and obviously at that point had natural immunity, had had minimal symptoms lasting maybe 24 hours on each occasion. We fought the case all the way. The mother wanted the vaccinated, the father didn't. We fought the case all the way up to the Rhode Island Supreme Court. At the Rhode Island Supreme Court, just a couple of days before they actually heard the case, a petition, what's called an amicus curiae brief, a friend of the court brief, had been filed by 70 very respected academics and clinicians on our behalf, including a former president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, president of the American College of Pediatrics, major investigators from Ivy League institutions, and then many clinicians working as pediatricians, as primary care docs. The court wouldn't even entertain the amicus curiae brief. They just summarily rejected it and kept what had been a lower court decision at that point, which was that the children had to be vaccinated. And about a few couple of weeks later, under the most brutal conditions, because the father, again, who had objected to the vaccination, was allowed to be there in the pediatrician's office. These two young girls were forcibly vaccinated against their will. There was an audio recording of it made. The younger child was so traumatized, she tried to hide from the pediatrician and the pediatrician's assistant underneath a table and defecated on herself. You could hear the screaming and everything. And so the father actually filed a complaint with the Rhode Island Department of Health against the pediatrician, which was just also summarily dismissed. So fast forward to this current case, where the circumstances are not that much different in terms of the clinical evidence and certainly the science hadn't changed, but in this case it's two adolescent boys whose mother doesn't want them vaccinated in a divorce case, and the father insists upon it. Well, unlike what happened in Rhode Island, we were actually allowed to present to the family court judge, although it's not called family court in Tennessee, it's a lower court. I was actually allowed to give him what amounted to a slide presentation for over 2 hours, going through basic subject matter, the epidemiology of COVID illness in children, and moreover the fact that the whatever risk was conferred by SARS-CoV-2, even at its most virulent, was really strictly confined to very high-risk populations that were easily identifiable, primarily the infirm elderly, and then somewhat younger groups that had profound comorbidity, Perry. We're talking about 6-7 comorbidities at once. That is completely irrelevant to healthy young children, particularly healthy young children who've already proven what COVID will be like in them because they've had it once or twice and have natural immunity. And very slowly and methodically, with many questions. I mean, after all, Perry, my presentation was literally just 12 slides. It took 2 hours and 15 minutes to walk the judge through that material with lots of, you know, intelligent questions. And lots of time for explanation when he didn't understand something. And lo and behold, that was in December, lo and behold, you know, some 6 to 8 weeks later, he rendered the opposite opinion. I mean, so to me, it points out certain things, hopeful things and things that are not so hopeful, which is that when you're given an opportunity to present real evidence-based medicine. And I walked him through clinical trial data, through observational data on COVID risk, through observational studies on how robust natural immunity is, and the very low risk to children. I even, Perry, at one point, the morning of the hearing, I went to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System data, the national database that CDC sponsors, specifically for Tennessee. And lo and behold, I found that among 6 to 17-year-old Tennesseans, males, because the children in question here were boys, adolescent boys, there had been 7 cases of myopericarditis in Tennessee. Five of which required hospitalization, and that was just in less than 3 years. In more than 10 years of comparable data for influenza vaccination in 6 to 17-year-old males, there hadn't been a single case. And I presented that information to him as well, right in his own backyard. And so the hopeful thing was that, you know, once you're allowed to present the evidence, you at least have a chance to avert the outcome that we had in Rhode Island. But I mean, are we really at a point where it becomes that arbitrary, Perry? Where now this was kind of a blue district in a red state. In my state, in Rhode Island, it's overwhelmingly blue, and the response to COVID here was just absolutely draconian insanity. So it does highlight something that's disturbing, which is that you may not be given a chance to present a solid case against COVID vaccination of healthy young kids in a state like Rhode Island.
Gosh, that's stunning. So. When the medical evidence shows that the vaccine in children is a bad thing, even the mortality rate is an amazing figure itself. Can you update us on that?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of just independent of vaccination, and actually, we made the comparison between COVID vaccination and polio vaccination because Dr. Fauci, amongst others, has made that spurious comparison. So as it stands now, so for example, in my state of Rhode Island, the CDC estimates by doing what's called seroprevalence, Perry, where they just look for, they take a random representative sample of the population, various age ranges in kids. The random sample done in Rhode Island for antibody positivity to SARS-CoV-2, the estimate is that 100% of kids in Rhode Island had been infected. We didn't have a single COVID death in Rhode Island. And that's by taking the Department of Health to court over that issue. They had to admit there hadn't been a single childhood death due to COVID. Now, broadly, you know, worldwide, it looks like during the period where the virus had more virulent strains, more deadly strains, it was maybe one in about 335,000. So per 335,000 infections, you might have one death. And those are usually confined to kids that had congenital developmental abnormalities, chronic lung malformations, neurodevelopmental diseases, kids that had been in and out of the hospital chronically, not healthy kids. When we get onto the Omicron stage, you know, where the virus becomes even less virulent, we're now above one in a million, and it's again, it's the same thing. It's only kids with profound lifelong you know, developmental and other profound medical conditions that possibly die from a COVID infection. And often there, Perry, it's very difficult to determine if it's the COVID infection itself which killed them, or perhaps related to their chronic comorbidity. So that's the epidemiology. In terms of myopericarditis, we know, particularly in young adolescent males, probably the best data still come out of Israel. It may be as high as 1 in 3,000, 1 in 6,000 that can develop myopericarditis. And now that isn't common. That's rare, and rarer still, but still reported. There have been autopsy proven cases of death in adolescents. Those are exceedingly, thank God, those are exceedingly rare. But there were at least two reports in the medical literature in the United States in adolescent boys.
Fascinating. So one quick question before I take a break. Can you elaborate on what the potential long-term implications are for those young people who receive the vaccine?
Yeah, this I can't speculate. And that's a terrible unknown that we have. And that's another reason, you know, given how low risk COVID is, again, other than in these extreme, you know, if you have a child with cystic fibrosis, perhaps, and I'm not even sure there, the benefit might barely outweigh the risk. I can't say for sure, but any healthy child, absolutely not. I mean, that's well established. And then putting aside the complete unknowns, which are any possible long-term effects. Well, maybe when we come back, I would like to compare, for example, what we know about polio vaccination versus coronavirus vaccination.
No, I get that. One other quick question, that is there something else looming out there that would take us down this road again?
Only if we let it. I don't know how else to answer that question, Perry. I mean, yes. Unfortunately, we're learning now that this really, really awful and dangerous gain of function research has not been shut down. Could there be another such pathogen that gets out that's actually more virulent than coronavirus? It's a dreadful possibility.
All right, let me take a quick break. You can go to Andrew Bostom, BOSTOM.org is his website, to check out all the resources that he have there. We'll be back with Dr. Bostom in just a moment.
We'll be back to this week's interview in just a few seconds. In the meantime, we want to let you know that you can watch this interview, plus many more exclusive interviews that happen this week on the Dove's Daily TV and radio show, by visiting our website, thedove.us. And while you're there, sign up for our free daily devotional, The Word for You Today. 3 months of daily readings that will connect you with God's Word. Now, back to the show.
Okay, welcome back, and delighted to have back with us today Ryan Bomberger. Ryan is the co-founder and the chief creative officer at the Radiance Foundation, and you can go to radiancefoundation.org. There's the picture of their landing page there, radiancefoundation.org. He also happened to be in attendance last week at the State of the Union address, which is interesting, and I do want to talk to him about that. Ryan, good to see you. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Fine. Good to see you again. First of all, what's the Radiance Foundation?
The Radiance Foundation is an educational, faith-based, factivist nonprofit that loves to illuminate that every human life has God-given purpose.
Good for you. Good to see you. You're a busy guy. I got the reading on you. When do you sleep?
Not often. I have four teenagers, too, so, you know, homeschooled teenagers, so never sleep.
All right, so you got to attend the State of the Union address. You were the guest of Congressman Bob Good there. What was your impressions of the event?
Well, one, it's always just a wonderful honor and privilege to be able to participate in civic life, to be able to participate in governmental things. And so it was an honor to be invited by Representative Good. I'll tell you, you know, before the cameras go on, it was more like a sorority party. And that's the kind of behavior that I felt like was it didn't fit the chamber, it didn't fit the event. A lot of the legislators were taking selfies, laughing, cackling. It was a little crazy. And of course, it was the crazy kind of continued into the speech. But it was so amazing just to be there with so many different Americans, obviously across the political spectrum, just to be able to hear the president address what the State of the Union currently is.
I had that high honor myself to attend the last State of the Union address of George W. Bush. And to your point, I think you sit there and you realize you're in a chamber. It's an awing moment where you are recognizing the diversity of our country. You're sitting there, the decorum of the place and everything like that. So I can share that feeling with you because it's an amazing thing. I guess when I got done listening to this past State of the Union address, I had to break it into two categories, the delivery and the content.
Right.
And because it was just an amazing, staggering moment that we got yelled at for an hour. I don't know what is to come of this, but the fallout from this has been anything but pleasant. But people are giving him cheers because he made it all the way through. What has happened to us?
We have lowered the bar. I mean, we have extremely lowered the bar. I was actually, I don't know if you want to say privileged, to sit behind media, and I was listening to them the entire time gushing over President Biden. And sure, he was coherent through the entire speech. I mean, he messed up a few times, but that's a given. Anybody will make mistakes. But the fact that the achievement was that he made it through is not an achievement. The achievement should be in the policies that actually better every American's life, or at least better the collective, you know, status of the entire nation. And that's not what we're seeing. They were very uncritical, of course, of all the false assertions that were made, which pretty much the speech was replete with.
Ryan, I want to tug on your heart for a moment. The stunning moment for me, there was a lot of them, but the one that really got to me, I mean, I didn't even know how to react. It nailed me in my own living room. And that's when he went after the Supreme Court for overturning Roe versus Wade, making a dictatorial statement that he was going to correct that. I don't know what he has in mind, but he made that. And then to have a large portion of the room stand and cheer the killing of babies. I'm still in recovery. I don't even know how to take that when I watch the House chamber, a big portion of those people stand and cheer the killing of babies. I know your heart. How did you handle it?
Well, as someone who was conceived in rape but adopted in love, as someone who grew up in a family of 15 where 9 of my other siblings were adopted, as a father of 4 children, 2 adopted, the husband of a wife who rejected the violence of abortion when she faced her own unplanned pregnancy in her late 20s, I was appalled at the celebration of the killing of life. It wasn't like the president even mentioned any kind of support for mothers, because that wasn't part of the speech at all. But no, it was this, you know, uproarious clapping and applause for the destruction of our posterity. And that broke my heart, because this is where we are in our nation. I mean, the president was talking about how, you know, that created equal applies throughout our whole lives. Those are the words that he said toward the end of the speech. I'm like, well, your party still doesn't get created equal right, because you celebrate the destruction of the most defenseless, the most marginalized among us. So I was blown away by the celebration of the violent injustice of abortion.
Do you think that he sent a message that this is going to be a campaign issue for those on the left?
Well, of course, State of the Unions are pretty much campaign speeches. And this was certainly no different. Remember, in 1974, in an interview with the Washingtonian, Joe Biden at that time, Congressman Joe Biden at that time, said Roe went too far. And he was actually right in 1974. You fast forward to 2024, and it's all about the most radical abortion agenda possible. And that's the sad part. It's not about what can we do more to help women in difficult circumstances. It's no, let's provide the violence of abortion. Let's empower and enrich abortionists, but let's not empower women facing situations that can easily be overcome when they have a network of support.
How did you handle him scolding the Supreme Court on the decision and then vowing to overrule them?
Well, there are three branches of government. I think there are a lot of legislators who forget that. The Supreme Court is only one. And the Supreme Court often forgets what its role is, which is to interpret the law, not to make up law. But the Supreme Court was absolutely right in striking down Roe v. Wade, which even liberal scholars said was unconstitutional. So they are serving their role. It was unconstitutional. The majority ruled that. And the veiled threat, or maybe it wasn't so veiled, was kind of bizarre. And he launched into how you don't understand the women's political power. Well, you don't understand, President Biden, that there are millions upon millions of women who oppose the violence of abortion. So which women? The women who are pro-abortion? Yeah, but there are many women who are pro-life. And so the left always ignores the women who actually are standing up against the violence of abortion. I mean, look at the majority of pro-life organizations. They are led by women. The 3,000 pregnancy centers across the country, they are mostly led by women. The 450 maternity homes across our nation that serve mothers and their children, mostly led by women.
That's well said. So, looking at the states, there seems to be a solid move to even increase the restriction of abortions. We have to be encouraged by that. We live in a blue state, a very blue state out here in Oregon. But nonetheless, across the country, since Roe versus Wade has been overturned, it's become a state battle. What's your outlook?
Well, I have to be hopeful. I mean, one, because my life is centered around the author of hope. And so I have to look at things that way, because when you look through the broken lenses of the world, it can depress you and give you nothing but anxiety. So I'm looking at the small victories in the states that have banned the violence of abortion. I celebrate that. In states where, you know, they have codified the destruction of unborn human life throughout the entire pregnancy, I'm encouraged by people who are new to the fight and are willing to stand up and battle this. And it's going to be a long slog. The problem was the Supreme Court never should return to the states, because the situation of the existence of human life, of the right to life, should never be a state-decided issue. That is something that's beyond all of our payroll. That's why, you know, in the Declaration of Independence, our inalienable rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness don't come from government, don't come from man or woman, but they come from God, from our Creator.
Do you think the faith community understands where we are in this argument today?
Okay, I don't want to be negative here, but I'm going to say no. We wouldn't have the situation that we have if the church actually had risen up. Now, obviously, many of my colleagues are Catholic, and I love my Catholic brothers and sisters are the reason why there is a pro-life movement. Mm-hmm. I grew up non-denominational, evangelical, and there are many churches in that vein that have been silent, that have been sitting on the sidelines. But I am encouraged because there are some churches who are awakening to this, who are rising up to this, who are supporting pregnancy centers, who are talking about the issue, who are, you know, bringing in training in their Sunday schools. Like CareNet has Making Life Disciples, great curriculum for Sunday school. So I'm encouraged that there are some victories here. Right. But in large part, the church, if it does not awaken, when the church is silent, evil flourishes.
Yeah. So what does your foundation do? I mean, you told me what you do, but how do you physically get involved with all this?
Well, we have four main components. One of it is we create these ad campaigns, billboard campaigns, social media campaigns about the issue of life, about racism, fatherlessness, poverty, basically the war on common sense. Then we also have our outreaches, like our adoptedandloved.com initiative, where we actually help fund families' adoption journeys. We are factivists, so we write op-eds almost every week for Town Hall, Christian Post, and several other news outlets. And then we also have our speaking engagements, where we do about 60 multimedia live talks around the country, places like Harvard, Princeton, University of Notre Dame, the list goes on, and help raise millions for pregnancy centers in those live multimedia presentations. So that's, in a nutshell, what we do through the Radiance Foundation to illuminate that every human life has God-given purpose.
That's wonderful. One last question, Ryan, and are young people awakening to this?
Oh, yes. In fact, one of the organizations we love working with a lot is Students for Life, that have thousands of chapters across the country on college campuses and in high schools. They are proof that, you know, Gen Z is awakening to this, that they are on the front lines of fighting this. So there is encouraged you know, there's some encouragement when you see some of the polls too, some of the younger people who don't accept what some older generations have accepted. Mm-hmm. So I'm really encouraged. I know it firsthand because we work with them all the time. In fact, the State of the Union, that was a partnership with Students for Life. I'm really grateful for that organization.
You're an amazing guy. Let me say to our viewers and listeners, check out Ryan's website, Radiant Foundation. There's a picture of the landing page there. That's radiancefoundation.org, by the way. Perfectly consider supporting what they do, radiancefoundation.org. Ryan, good to see you again, friend. Let's stay connected. God bless you, pal. Stay in the fight.
Thank you. God bless.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to this week's Focus Today podcast. Remember, you can visit our website to check out all the interviews we did this week on our daily Focus Today TV show at thedove.us. And if you like this podcast, please take a moment to rate us and share it with your friends.